Hello, Scott. Yeah, I'm just opening with a boring introduction because I was not fumbling with my recording device or anything like that. It's just because I wanted to give you space to be able to express your feelings, because I know that oftentimes I will just like slam into a show and just not even let you get a word in edwise. And that's just a terrible thing when that happens. And worse, when it happens and the person who's doing it becomes aware that they're doing this kind of thing and then they refuse to stop. Don't you just hate that, Scotty? Yeah, I agree. It is terrible.
Hola, mi amigo. Estoy muy emocionado de hablar contigo hoy.
Are you going to España?
No, that's it. I mean, I'm out of Spanish now.
Okay. Where are you? You're GMT plus two, so you told me.
Yeah, I'm in Valencia.
Ah, well, that's very nice. Are you having lots of oranges?
No, I haven't had an orange at all yet. No. It's we tried a little experiment of just being away for a little while and working from somewhere else. So we're going to be here for 5 weeks.
Wow.
And to see how it goes.
What are you sending all your lucky listener?
All my lucky listener, what I'm going to send, love and affection, and that's it. Nothing else.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. No, it's the way I describe it is we were looking to be empty nesters, but is that a phrase you use in the US, empty nesters?
Absolutely.
Yeah. We were looking to be empty nesters, but the birds refused to leave, so we found a new nest.
That's so funny. I'm going to try that.
So, anyway, there we are.
Did you at least leave a note or something, like gone fishing or something?
Yeah, so something like that. Bye. Oh, so John, we better talk about something that is useful to our listener. Car mechanics. No, I don't know. How are you this week? What have you been up to?
Well, I was traveling a bit, so I was down in Los Angeles last week, and I got to go to one of the performances of Netflix as a joke series, which was really good. There was we did a bunch of live broadcasts last week, so, you know, keep upping our live game, which is nice to see. And then I went straight to New York because, unlike you, I love my child. At least my children, the ones that I know about, because he finished his first year in college and I was foolish enough to volunteer. Well, I was voluntold, to help him move. So, you know, this being an engineering school and him being a mechanical engineer major, he decided the easiest way to move trunks was just to put it on a skateboard and ride them down the hill and use the fact that he wears kind of, you know, these work boots that have strong soles, which are not very presentable, but they help act as a brake. So that was my huge accomplishment.
So I am assuming if he was moving with a trunk and a skateboard, he wasn't moving back from New York to California.
No.
Because that's quite a long way on a skateboard.
It is. I hadn't even thought about that. No. I guess context matters, doesn't it?
It does. Because, you know, he's now like, he's just, by the time he gets back, it's time for him to go back again. In fact, I don't think he'd even make it before he got back again.
I would probably tell him to turn around sometime by the time he gets to Nebraska.
Yeah.
But Somewhere around there. He's moving out of a dorm room and then moving his stuff and his person to a fraternity where he will be spending a good chunk of the summer. But he is coming home to show his cohort, a couple of his friends, San Francisco, and I don't think any of them have been there. And so it's as shocking and delightful living in the East Coast when you've been raised in California. I think seeing California in general and San Francisco in particular is a surprise and a delight. And probably a shock as well.
Well, there we are.
But nobody wants to hear about our talking about our kid.
No, they don't at all. So other than they want to know what software he used to calculate the speed ratios and whatever else of the skateboard, but we probably don't know. No. So basically what you're saying is you've been on a jolly for a couple of weeks and therefore you've done bugger all.
It's not entirely true, but it's like one of those things where it's like, things I can't talk about. All right.
Yes.
Yeah. What I can talk about, which is not terribly exciting, but interesting-ish, is, you know, I think I'd said in shows prior that we have a pretty extensive deep linking system. And so I made more changes, did more migrations of it. And so I think we are at this point where, you know, within another, 6 months or so, we will have I probably kind of rewritten the app entirely. You know how they're like, I think every 7 years or something, every cell in your body has been replaced. Well, I think it's, we're getting somewhat close to the, to having replaced all the code that was originally written. Well, that maybe that's a little bit ambitious, but a good chunk of it. And we are definitely in the process of doing a pretty big paradigm shift about how things are managed, especially with related to things like startup and you know, managing interdependent asynchronous tasks, and figuring out better systems for doing it. Because you know what you notice with any complex app that is constantly being evolved and new features added, when you start up, it's like, oh my God, there's like this land grab or attention grab, because you have to kind of balance getting all the background services running as quickly as possible and getting you onto your path to where you're going. But a thing about a mobile app is that what you want to do with it kind of depends on the time of the day and where you are and all sorts of things in a way that, let's say, a TV app isn't, because TV apps don't, you know, they don't move and they don't change networks and so on and so forth, at least not very often. But a mobile app, when you're picking it up, there are different interaction models. Maybe you are going to sit down, like you're getting on a plane. It's like, okay, in this case, chances are you probably downloaded a bunch of titles and you want to watch them. That's one thing. If you are picking it up and you're on the go, maybe you want a quick interaction. So trying to guess which things are the most important things and the order in which to do it is you know, and to recover from errors and deal with maybe bad networking and so on and so forth, that's a tricky thing at startup. So there was been a big effort to make a system for managing that a lot more sane than what was possible, you know, 7-8 years ago when the startup routines were created. And you think about all the things that need to come down to the server, especially with respect to new experimentations, where you kind of say, "Hey, is this device going to be running an experiment? If so, which code needs to be executed, and so on and so forth? And if there are new features to be shown, and you have feature education, that's another issue. So startup is a rhymes with rich. It's pretty complicated, and layered on top of that, why I'm talking about all these things is the whole question of dealing with deep links, because deep links can launch the app if it's not already running. And if that happens, then you may have things where the deep link may even specify that you need to have a specific profile, and that may not, you know, be the profile that you're using. So all this complexity and all this orchestration, it ain't easy. So those are the things that I can talk about, and it's been occupying my mind. How about you, Scotty?
Yeah, startup and complex applications is, I think, you know, it's we had a bug in a client application recently where we fixed a warning, and yeah, it went through QA and it went through normal developer testing and all's fine. Then the app got released and suddenly support was being flooded with the app doesn't work anymore issues. And, you know, it was a sort of a bit of a case that by fixing the warning, it changed something that was happening. But basically an object was being loaded from a user default. And basically, the previous code had said, you know, let my variable of type optional any equal user defaults dot standard, you know, object for key or whatever. Now, and it was taken. Basically, the linter was saying, look, you don't, you know, this optional any is not required, it's surplus to requirements, so just, you know, you can get rid of it. So yeah, it seems a simple warning fix. It cleans up, you know, cleans up a warning, so you're not always having to go around it. But the difference is it turns out that if you load an object from user defaults into an optional any, and it doesn't exist, you get an object that has some value of nil. As opposed to just getting nil. So of course that then changed the code path that was happening for people who did not have this user default, which tended to be people on a lot who started out on a lot older version of the app. And so suddenly some startup value was being different, and because the app was never expecting this to really happen. There were places around the app that were defending against this value being, you know, this value being there in certain circumstances. I'm trying to be very vague here in order to not give certain things away. This value to be there, and therefore was had guard statements saying, guard, not this value, else return. So, of course, suddenly this value was in the app. Never been there before, and the guard statements were doing exactly what they had been written to do, which was just return, but that return meant the app didn't work anymore. So lessons learned to be careful about it raised a number of issues. Personally, be careful about fixing warnings because they don't always behave the way you think they are, and secondly, sometimes it's really hard, and I'm sure you have this, and maybe you, because of your resources, we can't speak, you get around this, but sometimes if a user has been in your app for a long time, the app may have been through several states and several different ways, and they've not necessarily signed up. They signed up in version 2 and you're now on version 14 and the sign up flow is different. Their settings may be slightly different because they didn't set certain things during their sign up that the version 13 does set up, and something changes and it causes one of those values to be different. And so, yeah, testing long running users is quite difficult.
Yes, it is. And it's almost impossible to do in any type of lab setting. I have a couple of things to say. First of all, we now have our show title. It's like a riff on Nobody Expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes, something like that.
Nobody expects the nil value for user defaults. But I think the second thing is with long-running things, trust no one and no thing. Because there's... It's interesting. It's a completely kind of, super detail, which you never think about when you're first looking at it. But I remember coming into a code base and saying, gosh, there's all these things about like non-nil value for key or safe set value for key, on NS Dictionary. Because back in Objective-C days when you could, do all sorts of things like that, there was nothing to stop you from doing it, and then you run an application out there in the field and you were counting on getting a value for key that either exists or is of a certain class, and then you may see bunches of code where you're saying, wow, this is a lot of testing, and basically having slowly but surely doing the things that Swift gives you at a language level with if-let and guard-let and so forth, and it absolutely bites you in the derriere over time. And I honestly don't know how you can practically, solve this problem without having, other than to observe things and be very careful every time you make a new release and just basically make people aware of it. So, I mean, I'm curious about this one other thing not to reveal that you're working on Grindr or anything, but when you release a new version of a software, do you go the kind of slow rollout thing with 1% look at bugs, or do you just like slam it out there 100%?
Funnily enough, we had this discussion before this release, and we've done both. And the decision was for this release, there's nothing that should be too dangerous in it. Let's just put it out there. And of course, that wasn't the case. This is an app with a lot of users, and therefore when something goes wrong, because the support emails, not that we ever see the support emails necessarily as developers, but the support desk can literally go mad. When your app has a lot of users, if you get an email on something, it gets read, it gets noted, an issue gets created, but probably not a lot happens. When you start getting, the more emails than your team can read coming in, you realize that's probably something wrong, and you respond to it straight away. It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because if no answer, I think one of the things is you don't know what's happening because this is a state that you're not expecting. Let me just be clear again. Basically, it was just we removed the type declaration from this statement, this let statement, because it said it was superfluous. But actually, having the type statement returned one value and not having it return nil. But I think one thing that has been learned and will become part of code reviews going forward is if you have a guard state that is there to protect you from things that shouldn't happen, if it does happen, you should indicate that somehow. So we're probably going to be using a whole bunch of new analytics. Then, of course, in this instant, if we'd had analytics in this place, we'd have been able to say, well, the reason, you know, the reason people are saying their apps aren't working is because we've seen a 15,000-fold increase in this analytic being written in the last 2 hours. You know, we virtually never see it, and now we've seen, 200,000 or whatever, just because working out and tracking it down. And I think another thing that I learned from this is it is really difficult when you're in this, we've made a release, something's gone wrong, you're trying to get it fixed as soon as possible because there are a lot of users being affected by it, to actually remain incredibly logical and follow the problem through in a very calm and organized manner in a team is quite difficult. And you can jump to a whole bunch of, well, it must be around here because this is where, you know, people are reporting the problem. Whereas, you know, this line of code that was problem was nowhere near. It was in the startup code. It was miles away from where the problem was actually showing itself. And so actually debugging in those situations is for a team, I think there needs to be, you know, if your team has never been through this, you know, very clear procedures. This is how we do it. This is where we start. This is how we walk through things. This is the resets. This is the set of practices we're going to use to find this problem, because it is, in the heat of the moment, very tempting to just run all over the place and start saying, it must be this, it must be that. And the thing is, it was fixed pretty quickly. Expedited review was used. And, you know, it was sort of like 12 hours after the problem was first noted, there was a new build out there. Most people were fixed and, you know, whatever else. So at the end of the day, it's, you know, not so bad. But, you know, lots of lessons learned.
Well, Scotty, now you told us that you went to Spain because you were trying to outrun your children. Is it not? Are you not revealing the fact that Mark Zuckerberg personally ripped you a new one at 4 a.m. and you had to escape East Bollockshire because he knew where you live?
I am happy to confirm two things. One, I am not working for Mark Zuckerberg. Okay. Without any gloating at all, it was not my code that broke.
None implied.
So there we are. I can so there we are. I will leave it at that. Talking about complex testing, last year I was speaking about how we had an app that we were migrating people from one version of to another within it, and how complicated migrations are. Well, one of the things we were doing at the time is we were limiting our migrations to people who only had the app on one device, because obviously migrating, as again you're going to know, migrating someone from one system to another incompatible system when they might be running on multiple devices contains a whole new set of problems. Whereas now I'm working on the let's do multiple devices. And I just want to say, I'm not going to go into detail right now. I'll talk about it once we're finished or coming to the end, and we'll do I'll do one retrospective on my views on migration of things. But yeah, people having multiple devices should be made illegal.
I think people actually using your software should be, I mean, they should be required to pay, but they shouldn't be allowed to use it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, especially when you're combining front end, back end, middleware, and each different thing has a different set of incompatibilities. Yeah, there's a whole range of things to test and check. It's a known scope of things that have to be checked, and in fairness, they're not that huge. But actually, just the amount of time it consumes doing testing, you know, getting getting four devices into exactly the state you need them to run a test, and then running the test, and something doesn't happen, or something does happen, and then so you do it again. So you have to get four devices back into the state to run the test, particularly if you're trying to simulate, you know, someone who has a lot of data and uses app a lot and whatever else. Yeah, it's just an incredibly, incredibly time-consuming and dull on the whole enterprise. So there we are. That is my life. That's why I have come to do it in the sunshine instead of in the rain.
Because after fighting this, at least at the end of the day, you can say that I have seen the sun. Well, I mean, Scotty, not to keep digging into vague things that I can only give sparse details about, but listening to you about this, about, you know, getting multiple devices into a certain state, I have been living that for months now in trying to on this project that I've been working on, but there was definitely lively discussion about how you can prove that something is going to work. And graybeard that I am, I just want to say you never really can until you actually do it. So knowing that, you basically have to set things up so you can observe properly, and you have to test in as close to the environment as possible. And when you're talking about multiple devices all around the world with different networking conditions, that is almost impossible to do. It really is, because if nothing else, to have the level of expertise to understand very, very specific problems almost certainly means that the person that has that level of expertise, God bless them, because they have that on certain details. They may not see the whole. And by the same token, the people who just think, "Oh yeah, just in the overall picture, this, you know, these little minor details are only going to affect a few people, so let's just slam forward." And I think that what you said was absolutely true, that you have to define a process, that that's more important. And sometimes you learn these kind of methodical debugging and crisis management things that can't easily be taught other than you going through it, and it kind of sensitizes you to things. And then in the future, you tend to be more careful because you don't want to, it's more empathy than anything else. And when you're talking about trying to take an expressed business need or, you know, logic need and then express it in code, it can take a long time to make sure that people really are A, clear about what the logic is supposed to be, and B, make sure that the people who are requesting and saying this is how it should work, you know, describing it in a spreadsheet or in a flow diagram in a document or something like that is one thing. It's great, gives you some points of departure and discussion, but only when it's actually executed in living, breathing code that people can actually touch and themselves internally in a company and put it out there will you ever find out, does something really work? And this is particularly true when you can go into projects and you can have somebody who's like, I am fully confident in my methodology and, you know, I've understood the problem, I've asked all the questions, we've expressed the logic in a 75, you know, by 75 matrix in a spreadsheet, and I've built a state engine and unit tests to make sure that my code is provably correct. And it may very well be for that one aspect of it, but something else that happens that you may not be aware of, like, you know, some other asynchronous process running in the background that takes longer than you expected, causing a timeout or whatever, like a million different things you can come up with, and all your perfect unit tested code, you know, fail to shield you from this other problem. And what I've come to realize is that, you know, as in life, people can get very kind of devoted to their way of thinking and acting because their life experience, you know, tells them to do that. And I think the most important skill that you can have in life, which is therefore the most important skill you can have in software engineering, is the ability to, you know, take advantage of your experience, but not be bound by it, not blindly bound to it because things change or things that you never expected to happen did in fact happen or do in fact happen. And if they haven't happened yet, mark my damn words, they will. How's that for vague philosophy?
That sounds pretty vague, but pretty, yeah, let's just stick with vague.
It is
difficult, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know the makeup of our audience, right. And you know how many people work on apps. You know, work in a corporate like you do, and are working on apps that are all over the place. I've got clients, so yeah, I do spend some of my time on this and some on other things. You know, some people right there just writing their app that is only going to be on every one device with one user. And I'll just say, enjoy it. It's all I can say.
Well, it is true. I mean, I get what you're saying. It's like, you know, there are a range of problems, a range of circumstances that, you know, a few years ago I never would have had, any, you know, imagined having experience with. Now I do. And now I've seen things. And you're right. Kind of like, you know, our audience member definitely tends to skew towards the kind of, you know, hobbyist or person who's interested in this thing. But one thing I can say is that programming and writing a piece of code and putting some type of expression of your heart and mind out into the world is a beautiful thing, whether it's a song or a poem or a piece of software or whatever. But you never know, or, you know, even a social media post, you never know how things will react until they're out there in the world. And that's true of any creative endeavor. And so there is always this kind of, you know, glorious time where you're imagining how things will be received. Like everybody's high-fiving. This is a great update. We're doing all these great things and everybody's happy. Let's have a beer. And then Monday morning comes around and all hell breaks loose. But I think that you should never let fear of what might possibly happen or what might possibly go wrong, you know, keep you from doing things. You just, you learn that when something, you know, bad or unexpected happens, that is definitely a rite of passage. And I noticed that even looking at my kid, who's like, as I'd said before, he's doing mechanical engineering, but there's no such thing as pure mechanical engineering. And he was sending me the kind of the summary of an experience he had building a robot, and it all came down to, it's like, well, the LiDAR hardly ever worked. So we had to kind of figure out some other things. And I think it's just a small microcosm of programming and putting things out there in the world. So if you are a casual engineer and just experimenting things, don't let all these, you know, vague philosophical rants keep you from experiencing the sheer joy of doing something, putting out in the world, and having a firestorm appear on your desk.
And I think with that, not having a firestorm appear under your desk is a great way to maybe wrap this thing up, John. So if people want to create a firestorm under your desk, how should they get hold of you to find out where to come and do that?
Well, you can do that in the place where all calm is always maintained, and that's on Mastodon, where you'll find me as Djembe, that's Djembe, like the West African drum, Djembe at mastodon.social, or you can find me on Threads, where I'm merely John Fox. And Scotty, if people want to determine your precise location and lob oranges at you, how might they do that?
Well, again, they can do that on Mastodon as well, where I am MacDevNet at mastodon.social. And I look forward to being spoken to. No one's spoken to me in a little while, if I'm totally honest.
Oh, okay. I think our fractional listener has to flood Scotty's mailbox or whatever, you know, notification center.
Well, John, it's been a pleasure as always to speak to you. And you're traveling and back. I'm traveling, but not back yet. But, you know, it's good to know that wherever we are in the world, we will still inflict pain on somebody somewhere.
Exactly.
There. So, and with that, we will say gracias por escuchar y hasta la próxima.
Oh my God. And people complain about my singing. Keep going.
No, you normally finish that.
Shit.
You normally finish that.
That's right. Okay. I can't even begin to do it. But what I will say is that you take care to always be nice to Sam so that when he has to edit this stuff, he'll do a nice thing and make things work well. So thank you for the editing on last episode, Sam. And until next time, you take care.
Slick as always. Slick as always. We'll be right back.